can start it, and hopefully Representative O'Neill and others who are not here can join us. The Minnesota House of Representatives Committee on Public Safety and Criminal Justice Reform will come to order. First item of business is to conduct the roll. So the clerk can take the roll.
Chair Mariani.
Present.
Vice Chair Frazier.
Present.
Representative Johnson.
Present.
Representative Edelson. Representative Edelson.
Present.
Representative Feist.
Present.
Representative Grossel.
Present.
Representative Hollins.
Present.
Representative Hewitt.
Present.
Representative Cleavorn, sorry.
That's all right. Present.
Representative Long.
Present.
Representative Lucero.
Blessed with zero technical difficulties for now.
Representative Mueller.
Present.
Representative Novotny.
Present.
Representative O'Neill.
She is having technical issues.
Okay, thank you. Representative Pinto. Representative Pinto.
I am present, having some technical difficulties, but I'm present.
Representative Poston.
Present.
Representative Raleigh.
Raleigh present.
Representative Vang.
Present.
Representative Zhang.
Here.
Representative O'Neill. That concludes roll call.
Okay, very well. Members, we do have a quorum. This hearing is being conducted remotely on an electronic platform pursuant to Minnesota House Rule 10.01, Emergency House Operations in Response to the COVID-19 Infectious Disease Pandemic Requiring Public Health Exercise of Social Distancing. House Rule 10.01 can be found on the Minnesota House website, as well as information on how to view these proceedings via live streaming video and instructions for the public to be able to participate in public testimony. That can be found on the webpage, on the webpage of this committee on the Minnesota House website. Members, we've got, first of all, let me just inquire of the clerk if we have our minutes ready from the last meeting, because we might as well adopt them if we can.
Yes, they've been sent out.
Okay, very well. Can someone please move adoption of the minutes of January 11th?
Chair Mariani, I would move those minutes.
Thank you, Representative Polston. Representative Polston moves adoption of the minutes of January 11th. Discussion. Very well. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 All same sign. Motion prevails. And the minutes of January 11th of this committee this year are hereby adopted, and they'll be posted on our public website. Members, we have give me a second. I want to pull up the participants. I can track in particular when Representative O'Neill joins us. I really wanted members to ask Representative O'Neill to share a bit of an update from her community. As you know, was terrorized recently, tragically. We want to continue to, particularly as the Public Safety Criminal Justice Reform Committee, to constantly pay attention to how that community is doing. But hopefully we'll have a chance for her to do that share some updates when she comes back. Members, I also do want, at the end of the last meeting, there was a very quick reference to the Commissioner of Corrections regarding decisions or not decisions made about the release of Mr. Berry's daughter. He was here with us. Thankfully, Mr. Berry did share that he was awfully grateful for the work of the commissioner. I have been informed since then that, in fact, the commissioner had multiple times released Ms. Berry. She unfortunately got caught back up into the system. She even used the authority cited by Representative Johnson yesterday in order to exercise that decision. I think the issue before us, members, is that we have something that's not working in our correction systems, particularly as it interacts with people with mental illness. And that was at the core of Mr. Berry's testimony and observations and plea to us is to work on creating a system that is humanely effective for people with mental illness like his daughter. And so we really have a broken system, more so than we have a broken person. I hope that our work going forward continues to focus on how we can address those systemically and through the necessary lawmaking and appropriations that it takes to do that. So members, today's agenda involves House File 109, House File 377, and House File 499. They're all being carried by members who are not members of this committee. So, typically I want to try to get members who are not up first, but, we're just tossing a coin here. So we're going to pull up House File 109, Representative Noor. And the chair will, in order to get the bill before us, move to refer House File 109 to the Labor Committee. Representative Noor, welcome. Chair Noor, welcome to the committee.
Chair Mariani.
Representative Johnson.
I just received some information from Representative O'Neill. She's having a lot of technical problems, okay. And she's asking to be excused today.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Representative Johnson. I appreciate that. The clerk will note that on the record. Representative Noor, if you could please come forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. It's House File 109. This is a bill that we've had before in the last session. Members, this is a bill in relation to requiring automatic sprinklers in high-rise building. On November 27, 2019, a tragic incident happened in my district, in our community. In fact, even yesterday, we lost someone in a tragic fire incident. Our thoughts and prayers are with that family as they struggle with that loss. So we lost five people during the high-rise building in 2019. And most of the buildings in our state have sprinklers. Unfortunately, this building, which is in my district, did not have any sprinklers. And most of these buildings are in high-rise buildings, quite frankly, concentrated in the metro area. I know members will be talking about why we mandate or why we want a retrofitting high-rise building with sprinklers. This is about saving lives. It's about ensuring that no one is lost because we cannot install sprinklers. This bill was before the body in 1994 and 95, and the leaders during that time said it was a mistake. I don't want that to be a mistake again. We can do the right thing and making sure that we address health and safety of our communities no matter where they live. It's not about the resources, it's about the requirement that we're putting in. There are some exemptions and extensions included in there. So members, if you look through the process, you will see that the recent report from the Department of Public Safety, Fire Marshal's office, it clearly indicated if we had sprinklers in those buildings, we could have saved those five lives, but we didn't do what was needed before. So with that, members, I wanted to introduce individuals who really understand how fire sprinklers can save lives. We have the fire marshal with us today who is going to testify on this bill, Mr. Chair.
Very well. Thank you, Representative Noor. So we have several testifiers then. The first group, I suspect, are the ones that Representative Noor identified, Mr. Tom Brace, Jim Smith, and Trinidad Uribe, the third. And so let's begin with Mr. Tom Brace of the National Fire Sprinkler Association. Welcome to the committee, sir. If you can state your name for the record and provide us with your testimony, that would be welcome.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Tom Brace. By way of a brief background, I was the Washington State Fire Marshal for 10 years, and then I was the Minnesota State Fire Marshal for 16 years. And I do remember the legislative effort that Representative Knorr mentioned, 94 and 95. Both the House and Senate passed a high-rise retrofit bill. Actually, they did it twice, but it was unfortunately vetoed by the governor, who has since, in recent discussions, admitted that he thought he may have made an error in the veto. But for the historical record, I'd like to go just to some specific questions that have been developing and growing, if you will, as we progress this bill, or the bill has been progressed. Number one, a recent study indicated that this would affect, this bill with successful passage would affect about 43 properties and an additional 26 in the city of Minneapolis. So we've been able to identify to date about 69 buildings. We think the universe is probably less than 100. That would be affected by this. There's some very significant portions of this bill that are worth noting. The property owner, be it public or private, has 12 years to accomplish this effort. And there is a program where that property owner, as I say once again, public or private, would use the services, if you will, of the State Fire Marshal Division and discuss their plans to comply. A number of issues, the questions that we've had regarding funding has been mentioned. I'd like to mention just a couple of funding opportunities. I believe that probably we need to look more at the federal level for funding than at the state level at this particular point. Last year, there was a Public Housing Fire Safety Act sponsored by Senators Klobuchar and Smith. Senator Smith has reintroduced that bill this year and is looking for a House author. But a number of I think, important people and organizations have supported it, not the least of which is the International Association of Firefighters and the fire chiefs, along with public housing authorities and national organizations. The term to reduce the depreciation, it used to be approximately 39 years, has been reduced to 15. And in some cases, some extreme cases, now this is in commercial property, could be reduced in less time than 15 years. So there's a number of strategies out there that are looking to facilitate the use of sprinklers. But I'd like to also mention that we must not forget our fire service. The fire that Representative Knorr described so graphically, that was on the 14th floor. And all of that equipment was schlepped up 14 floors by a first-class fire department in a first-class city who fought a masterful job, and it took their entire fire department to put that out. So our fire service is also at risk, and we must remember their contributions and efforts in terms of their safety. Also, and of course, additionally, in many of these high rises, particularly in public housing, these are people that may suffer from English as a second language in terms of information communication to them, may also have some issues with health, mobility issues, age, children, young children, the list goes on. But these are exactly the kind of people we need and should and must protect. If you look at statistics nationally and in Minnesota, reported by the State Fire Marshal Division's collection, there are two groups that are at the greatest risk. Number one are children 10 and under, and our seniors 65 and over. And that description can explain a number of the occupants, if you will, in our high rise. It does see, and I'd like to close on this, that commercially, there are more opportunities than residential for funding, but I would like to assure the chair and the committee that there are significant efforts being made at the national level to find and identify resources. And remember that this bill, you have 12 years, repeat, 12 years to comply. I thank you very much for your attention. I stand ready for any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Brace. I apologize for calling you Tim and not Tom. And thank you, sir, for your service to Minnesota for all those years. You know, I was in the legislature in the early 90s, so I have vague recollections of that bill. And there was a concerted effort, for sure, for 2 years here regarding this. And, you know, it's never the wrong time to address whatever we didn't address well or accomplish earlier. And so I really appreciate both that moral call, but also the valuable information your provided us. If you can stick around for questions, that'd be great. We have three members already had their hands up. And now, members, I'm going to move on to Mr. Jim Smith, who I believe is our present State Fire Marshal. Mr. Smith, Fire Marshal Smith, please state your name for the record and provide us with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jim Smith, and I'm the State Fire Marshal for the state of Minnesota. I've been in the fire service since 1980, retiring in 2014 as Chief of Operations for the City of St. Paul Fire Department, and then I failed at retirement, and now I'm starting a second career in the Fire Marshal Division. I was appointed State Fire Marshal about a year ago. The fire that we're talking about, one of the more tragic ones that have hit the state of Minnesota. In Minnesota alone, since 2004, there were 64 high-rise fires or fires that started at the seventh floor or above. You will see in Representative Knorr's bill, it'll say 75 feet, and that is NFPA's description of a high-rise building, and typically that's going to be about the seventh floor or above, and that is directly related to the typical reach of a standard fire apparatus, aerial apparatus. In those 64 fires, in each one of those, a single sprinkler head extinguished the fire, and I need to emphasize that. One sprinkler head extinguished that fire. The main difference between those 64 fires and the tragedy that occurred on November 27th of 2019 at 630 Cedar is that there were no automatic fire sprinklers in any of the apartments or anywhere in that building. And that is a tragedy. The fire started very small. We have determined that the fire started in a room that was only 10 foot by 10 foot. It started small, it grew to very large proportions, and what exacerbated the situation is that a window blew out, and you may not recall, but there were high winds that night. And that apartment complex became a blast furnace. Unfortunately, the door to the apartment, to the hallway, was jammed open inadvertently. So, but that allowed thick, black, toxic smoke to fill the hallways, the stairwells. It made it unbelievably difficult to escape that building. And tragically for five innocent people, it made it impossible to get out of that building. The tragedy of losing those five people is only magnified by the simple fact that this disastrous fire would have been quickly contained, if not completely extinguished, had this building had automatic fire sprinklers installed. The mission of the State Fire Marshal Division has always been and will always be to protect the lives and property of every citizen of Minnesota and the people that are just passing through. To be clear, we have always and will always advocate strongly for the installation of automatic fire sprinklers in all multifamily high-rise dwellings. Through this legislation, proposed federal assistance, as the Honorable Tom Brace has talked about, from the federal level and public-private partnerships, we have a path now that leads us towards retrofitting every single multi-story apartment building in the state of Minnesota. And that would be an unbelievably wonderful thing to have. I thank you for your time, and I too will stand for any questions you may have.
Thank you, State Fire Marshal Smith. And then we have Trinidad J. Uribe III, Business Manager, Secretary Treasurer of the Sprinkler Fitters Local 417. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Trinidad Uribe III. That's U-R-I-B-E. Business Manager of the Sprinkler Fitters Local 417. We are established since 1903 here in the Twin Cities. So this technology has been around or at least for a very many amount of years. Thank you again for the opportunity to speak in support of House File 109. In buildings without fire protection sprinklers, the occupants and residents and first responders are at a complete disadvantage to survive when a fire occurs. It's not just the fire itself, but all the deadly gases that are created by the burning materials inside of these buildings. I'm a Minnesota certified licensed journeyman sprinkler fitter with over 21 years of experience and also have 10 years of experience as an instructor for our apprenticeship program. Prior to me becoming the business manager here at Local 417, I've had numerous opportunities to retrofit high-rise buildings, nursing homes, assisted living facilities, schools, and commercial buildings. So with calculated planning, the retrofitting of these buildings is not a very intrusive process at all. In my experience, residents would vacate the specific unit that was being worked on while the installation process was happening, and in some cases, only taking a portion of the day to get it completed. So this process of retrofitting can be done very efficiently and safely for the residents. This is an opportunity to ensure that we will not have any more lives lost due to the lack of fire protection in these buildings in the state of Minnesota. These existing high-rise buildings without fire sprinklers lack the new technologies of the fire sprinkler industries that newly constructed buildings will have. House File 109 will give that opportunity to make these buildings safe for all. Sprinkler Fitters Local 417 represent those who fabricate, install, maintain life safety fire protection systems within the state of Minnesota. My members not only work in the fire protection industry, but we are also great advocates for fire safety. In some cases, even sprinkle their own homes for the safety of their families. We save lives and protect property every single day. We believe in fire protection sprinkler systems and strongly support House File 109. Thank you very much, and I will be also here for any questions as well. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Uribe. We have, I will hold off on questions so we get all the testifiers here, and then we'll open up for questions and comments from the committee members. So appreciate the testifiers' willingness to stick around for that. We also have public testimony from Kyle Burt. I hope I pronounced your last name correctly.
That was right.
And you are Director of Public Policy, Minnesota Multi-Housing Association. Please state your name for the record and provide us with your testimony. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Kyle Burnt. I am the Director of Public Policy with the Minnesota Multi-Housing Association. We continue to evaluate the proposal, but wanted to highlight our primary concern for how this proposed sprinkler mandate could impact nonprofit and private naturally occurring affordable housing properties. Without including state funding in this proposal, these facilities would likely see an increase in rents to offset the cost of the mandate. We ask the author and committee members to consider funding to accomplish the sprinkler retrofit to ensure the facilities are safe and affordable. We are ready to be a resource for the author and members of the committee on this issue moving forward. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Burt. So why don't we open up for questions now. I'll start very quickly, and this is for our Fire Chief Smith. Again, I appreciate your testimony. I want to reference something that your predecessor, Mr. Brace, mentioned. I thought it was admirable, Fire Marshal Smith, that you really did focus on the citizens, the residents, you know, in these facilities. But Mr. Brace did mention, you know, that part of the issue here is also, you know, risk that could be incurred by our firefighters themselves. He mentioned, and I had this image, you know, painted in my pictures. I had this image painted in my head of firefighters clambering up 14 floors. I just can't imagine. And so I'm just very quickly, you can tell us, you know, what does that mean? You know, I mean, what, you know, I don't know. Does it mean you're dragging up hoses, axes? You know, how, you know, maybe just tell us a little bit about whether that's, you know, extremely dangerous and difficult or, you know, pro forma and part of the job.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. High-rise fires for a fire department are extremely they're tough to fight because we do not typically use elevators simply because elevators could end up being death traps. They could inadvertently end up on the floor of the fire or something like that. So we typically do carry up hoses, axe, extra air bottles to the floor below and then hook up to standpipe and move into the apartment. To your point, Mr. Chair, 1247 St. Anthony, which is the tall high-rise just on the north side of 94 in St. Paul, had a major apartment fire back when I was a firefighter for St. Paul. And we ended up doing the same thing. It was on, actually, that was on the 20th floor, way up there. The heat generated by these fires, when there's no sprinkler, is unbelievable. I did suffer significant facial burns on the side of my face from that fire. We were able to put the fire out. Since then, all of St. Paul's public housing have been retrofitted with sprinklers. And I look back now and I think after lugging up all that hose, all that equipment, and then fighting that fire and getting burned, that would have been a completely different story today because of the retrofitted sprinklers.
Thank you, Fire Marshal Smith. I appreciate that. All right, so let's go on to other members' questions. We have Representative Lucero, Representative Hewat, and Representative Johnson, Representative Hewat, or rather, I'm sorry, Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is the third time that I've heard this bill, once last year in this committee and then once earlier this week in the Commerce Committee. And as I've said last year and earlier this week to Representative Knorr, again, our condolences to your community. This is obviously a tragedy. It's one that none of us ever want in any of our communities, and our prayers go to the friends and family of the victims of the tragic loss as they continue to suffer with the loss of their family members. And so two of the questions that I have, actually one of them was brought up by, or he alluded to it anyway, Mr. Brace, in regards to the deductibility of the expenses. As a commercial property owner myself, Mr. Brace did mention that the depreciation schedule for most stuff, generally for commercial buildings, is 39 years, and there is different schedules for different types of equipment. But my question for the bill author would be, Representative Knorr, would you be willing to permit an accelerated depreciation, either all in the year of the expense it's incurred, or maybe in a shortened timetable, like 3 years?
Representative Knorr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that's a good question, which I think we have individuals with expertise. I see Mr. Brace ready to assist with this question. Mr. Brace, Mr. Chair.
Very well, Mr. Brace.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I believe we've just, as you correctly mentioned, in terms of commercial property, have accelerated the depreciation schedule, which used to be unbelievably long, opinions by Tom, of 39 years down to an average of 15 years, although it's my understanding that you can reduce that even further depending on the particular piece of property that you have and the amount of investment. Be happy to investigate this further. We're trying to expand that same accelerated depreciation as we speak nationally for residential property, but it only refers to commercial property. And we hear you, what you're saying about your desire to depreciate it. I did hear one speaker in the last several months argue it could be done in a year, but I think you need to take a look at the federal bill and sit down with your tax accountant and see how it might affect your specific piece of property of interest.
Terrific. Okay.
I have a follow-up question.
Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so, no, and that's, so this body, as we're well aware, we have tax conformity that we have to deal with every year. So we have the federal tax deductions that have to conform to Minnesota. And obviously, as Minnesota legislators, we can't impact past legislation impacting the schedules on the federal level. But it's certainly within our purview. And I think Chair Marquardt might even be on this call for a subsequent bill. So this would be something that would perk his ears. Just to consider, Representative Knorr, Chair Marquardt, others, that if we can, there's nothing stopping us at all from allowing for the building owners, while we're giving them 12 years to install, they're going to incur that cost if we could allow them under state tax code to depreciate that all in the year incurred. That would certainly help with the expense. And then the second question I would have, I guess it's more of a rhetorical question at this point, because unlike the earlier this week in Commerce Committee, we had a building owner that testified that the expenses that he had done when he retrofitted, I think, were $3,500 to $4,000 per unit. But the question I was going to have for him, if he was on this call, so maybe to Representative Knorr, do you know if that building owner incurred that expense before the lead law that currently kicked in, what was it, maybe 9 years ago or so, something to that effect? Because lead mitigation, lead paint, if there's 9 square feet that's disturbed, and certainly would be well over 9 square feet disturbed in retrofit of a building that's pre-January 1 of 1978, that increased the cost approximately 10%. So I am just wondering how that, did he have to encounter lead paint in his retrofit installation? Again, rhetorical question. And did he encounter asbestos and what impacts asbestos and lead might have in increasing the costs and the mitigations thereof of a retrofit installation. So thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Darr.
Thank you, Representative Lucero. And that was a rhetorical question, and so you're painting a picture for us about the extent of things that have to be considered in terms of cost for this. I appreciate that. Representative Huat, then Representative Johnson, Representative Hollins. Representative Huat.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Lucero, you're always so intriguing, and I love it because you teach me things about real estate that I don't know. But I got to tell you that every time I work with a real estate investor about looking at multifamily units, we go over all those things that might come upon that for their investment so they can get their ROI. I'm going to speak from this as a former firefighter and as an EMT. I have big concerns that we're waiting 12 years to do this. The life loss on this is horrible. This should not have happened, Representative Knorr. You and I have had discussions about this. This is despicable. And I don't think I need to say that we need to get this done quicker, but what I do want to talk about is where the chair kind of came in. I have a lot of friends that are firefighters. I have a lot of friends that go into these high rises. We spent tons of money on making these buildings tight so we can get cheaper heating bills out of them and cheaper efficiency out of them, but we didn't look at this. And every firefighter knows that a tight building is a frickin' nightmare. Words like backdraft and flashover go before our eyes. What the chief, I'm sorry, Marshall Smith, but what he was describing to you is a backdraft. This kills firefighters. And those, and going up in a high-rise story, and I've had friends around the country that have been killed in this situation, this is a bad day. And this, by sprinkling these units, and I've been in, I fought fires in Maplewood and in complexes, and it's amazing how we pay more for a data center to be retrofitted for sprinkler systems than we do someone's bedroom in public housing. I just need us to revisit this and look at this, because not only are we saving lives of occupants, but we're also saving lives of firefighters that get in these situations that are 20 stories up, and all of a sudden they see that puff of smoke under that door, and it's a bad day. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Huat, I can't even begin to imagine. Representative Knorr, you're hearing a strong appeal in terms of the timeline here. I suspect that'll be an ongoing conversation for all of us, particularly as you move into the next committee. Let's continue to struggle with that issue. Representative Johnson, then we're going to move to a vote, members.
Chair Mariani, members. Representative North, thank you for bringing this forward. We want to do all we can to protect our firefighters. They are heroes. I myself was a firefighter as well. I've been in the backdraft situation. I've carried up the hoses up those stairs numerous times, and the buildings that I was in would not qualify under this bill, but it's still it's work carrying that stuff up. And I appreciate the work of all our firefighters, especially the 90%+ across the state that are actually volunteers. I do have some questions on this bill. The issue of asbestos in these older ones was brought up, and lead paint. I won't discuss them. But I have a question on one of the exemptions on line 1.21. It says a residential building in which at least 70% of the dwelling units are the owner occupied. Does this bill exempt condominium complexes? Because there's residents in them as well.
Representative Knorr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that's a good question, and that was the purpose. I think Mr. Brace has got the background on this issue.
Mr. Brace, very quickly, please.
Yes, the direct answer at this point in time, it is condominium ownership of 70% or more would not require the retrofit sprinkler program. However, the property clearly would be deserving, but this was a decision we made to advance this bill.
Very well. Representative Johnson.
Chair Murray, members, I'm a little disappointed in that because the way this bill is written with that exemption, I have a bad feeling we're going to make the city of Minneapolis and St. Paul, where most of these buildings are at, I believe most are in Minneapolis. They're going to take these low-income housing units and turn them into condominiums, and we're going to lose our low-income housing availability. Do I want them to get the sprinkler systems in if they can? Yes. But it's, as other testifiers had mentioned, it's return on investment. I know they talked about the availability or possibility of federal funding for the next 2 years. There's probably going to be a lot of federal funding available, but we don't know what's going to happen in the next Congress, if that will be happening or not. We have a huge federal deficit that needs to be addressed. But there again, I like the concept of this bill. I don't think it should be mandated. I'm going to support it, but I think we should put incentives in place for these people to do it and not force them to do it. It's easier to lead a horse with two water, but we can't make them drink. And also it's easier to, have a carrot on a stick rather than having a whip behind them and getting them mad. So I do like the concept of this bill, but I want to make sure we don't hurt our low-income housing for those people that really need it. And I don't want these places turned into condominiums where they don't have to put them in either. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. Good points. And, incentives also pose challenges for us because then we're talking about usually resources that we're going to make available through appropriations, but that also might be a path forward for us as well. Members, we do need to vote on this bill. We have two other bills now. Representative Noor, final quick comments.
Get ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As you've heard, this is about saving lives. In any fire, you need fire alarms. You also need firefighters and fire sprinklers. Quite frankly, a firefighter was injured during this incident. So let's not make the mistake again. We have to act now to save lives and to support our firefighters as they battle this issue when it comes to high-rise buildings. So thank you, Mr. Chair, and ask for your support.
Very well. Thank you, Representative Noor. Members, the chair renews his motion that House File 109, we did not amend this, right? That House File 109 be referred to the Committee on Labor. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Mariani?
Aye.
Vice Chair Frazier?
Aye.
Representative Johnson?
Aye.
Representative Edelson?
Aye.
Representative Feist?
Aye.
Representative Grossel?
Aye.
Representative Hollins?
Aye.
Representative Hewitt?
Aye.
Representative Cleburne?
Aye.
Representative Long?
Aye.
Representative Lucero?
Yes.
Representative Mueller?
Mueller votes yes.
Representative Novotny?
Novotny, aye.
Representative O'Neill? Oh, yep. Representative Pinto?
Aye.
Representative Poston?
Aye.
Representative Raleigh?
Raleigh, aye.
Representative Vang?
Aye.
Representative Zhang?
Aye.
That concludes roll call with 18 ayes and 0 nays.
Very well. Members, with out of vote of 18 ayes, 0 nays, House File 109 is referred to the Committee on Labor. Thank you, Chair Noor, and to our testifiers, Mr. Graysmith, Uribe, and Mr. Burnt. Good luck with this very important bill as you move forward, Representative Noor.
Thank you very much.
Members, next is House File 377, Chair Joachim, a bill relating to firefighters with cancer or heart disease payment program established for counseling and training and money appropriated. The chair will move to refer House File 377 to the Committee on Ways and Means. And when we're done with our testimony, we will be laying this bill over for possible inclusion in this committee's omnibus finance bill. Representative Joaquin, your bill is before us, and you have an author's amendment, which I trust or I believe is will put the bill in the shape that the author wishes it to be before us today. Is that correct?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Thank you for hearing this bill. And the A1 reflects language changes requested by NAMI that better reflect the language regarding mental health programming.
Very well. Members, the chair will move the A1 amendment to House File 377. This puts the bill in the shape that the author wishes it to be. Any discussion? If not, the clerk will take the roll on the A1 amendment.
Chair Mariani?
Aye.
Vice Chair Frazier?
Aye.
Representative Johnson?
Aye.
Representative Edelson?
Aye.
Representative Feist?
Aye.
Representative Grossel?
Aye.
Representative Hollins?
Aye.
Representative Hewitt?
Aye.
Representative Cleavorne?
Aye.
Representative Long?
Aye.
Representative Lucero? Representative Lucero? Representative Mueller?
Mueller votes yes.
Representative Novotny?
Novotny, aye.
Representative O'Neill, excused. Representative Pinder? Oh, okay. Representative O'Neill?
O'Neill, aye. I voted aye on the last bill, too. I don't know if you heard me.
Okay, I did not, but I will note that. Thank you. Representative Pinto? Representative Pinto? Representative Poston?
Aye.
Representative Raleigh?
Raleigh, aye.
Representative Vang?
Aye.
Representative Zhang?
Aye.
Representative Lucero?
Sorry, I've got two Zooms going on at the same time. I'm in yes.
Okay, Representative Pinto? That concludes roll call with 18 ayes and one abstain.
Very well. Members, the A1 amendment is adopted to House File 377. And just a quick pause, so the record will reflect that Representative O'Neill had cast a positive vote, aye vote, on House File 109, final motion to refer to the Committee on Labor. Representative Joaquin, your bill, and then you've got a number of testifiers, and, you know, as usual, we're always pushing the clock here. So welcome, Representative Joaquin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members. For some quick background, the MnFIRE initiative is a 24-hour hotline that was started 3 years ago with funds from a small grant and many fundraisers. Within the first 24 hours of the hotline being open, it became apparent that there was a dire need in our firefighting community. Firefighters face cancer, cardiac issues, and mental health challenges at higher rates of than the rest of the population just for doing their jobs. Jobs that we ask of them and that many of us are not willing or able to do ourselves. They perform these jobs without hesitation, and we need to have their backs. The Hometown Heroes program is one of the ways that we can do that. Members, there are letters of support that are in your electronic packets from NAMI, Minnesota State Fire Department Association, American Heart Association, Minnesota Professional Firefighters Association, and the Minnesota Fire Chiefs. I have with me George Upson from MnFIRE Initiative, who is a retired fire chief from Eden Prairie. He will quickly go over the bill. We also have a few testifiers who will share their stories and what a program like this would have meant to them if it would have been in place. These folks are Chris Parsons, president of Minnesota Professional Firefighters and a captain with the St. Paul Fire Department, Steve Shapira, a retired St. Paul captain and cancer survivor, Jen Friends, wife of Matt Friends, former chief of the Rice Lake Fire Department. I know that the committee's time is tight, so that we each will only take a few minutes to tell you their stories, but it's really their voices that you need to hear.
Thank you, Chair Joaquin. A very important story that needs to be told. We've heard this bill in prior years, and it's not unusual for new members, for sometimes even good important bills to take some time to get across the finish line. Hopefully we can do that this year. With that, I'll call then Chief Espenson to come forward and provide us testimony, please state your name for the record, Chief.
Thank you, Chair Mariani and members of the committee. My name is George Esbenson. I am the president of the Minnesota Firefighter Initiative. Somewhere along the line, I missed a meeting and they had an election, and that's how that happens. So, and I also am a 32-year veteran of the Eden Prairie Fire Department, the last 17 as the fire chief. I just want to briefly recap the bill. So this bill seeks to do five things, but those five things combined will end the chaos that is the Minnesota firefighter experience when it comes to cancer, cardiac, and emotional trauma, the three big killers of active firefighters in the state of Minnesota. This bill will provide a statewide critical care policy. When an active firefighter gets a cancer or cardiac diagnosis, they will get a check of $30,000 to help them defray the costs of things that aren't covered by health insurance. It'll create a MinFire employee assistance program so that firefighters have a place to reach out and get fire-centric counseling. Right now what happens is when you go to your standard EAP, for those few firefighters that even have access to it, those people that are doing their very best to counsel the firefighters, but they have no idea what the firefighter journey is all about. It'll create an additional EAP resource for firefighters that need more than those initial five visits. It'll provide ongoing MinFire wear training for all 20,000 firefighters in Minnesota annually, because quite frankly, one of the keys to changing outcomes for firefighters in Minnesota is changing the culture of the Minnesota Fire Service and providing education and mitigation strategies around the issues of cancer, cardiac, and emotional trauma. The bill will also provide and sustain ongoing awareness training for medical and mental health providers, many of whom do not understand the unique rigors of the fire service. For instance, firefighters tend to get cancers and cardiac issues at much younger ages than the general population and suffer fatalities at 2.5 to 6 times those of the general population when it comes to cancer, cardiac, and emotional trauma. All combined, these five things is a holistic approach to addressing the problems. This is 32 years of experience and going to way too many hospital visits and funerals for my active firefighter colleagues over the course of my career. We've studied this very carefully. We have, as you see, many letters of support. And this is an investment in the Minnesota Fire Service that needs to happen so we can change the paradigm. Thank you for your time, and I'll be available for questions after the other testifiers. And I'd like to now turn it over to my colleague, Chris Parsons.
Thank you, Chief Espenson, and thank you for your service to our state for so many years and your ongoing and continued service, albeit drafted in. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Parsons. Please state your name for the record and give us your testimony.
Good morning, Chair Mariani and members of the committee. My name is Chris Parsons. I'm president of the Minnesota Professional Firefighters. I'm also a captain with the St. Paul Fire Department, and I am here in strong support of House File 377. I'm also here representing the colleagues from my own department, the five colleagues that have passed away in the last 5 years due to cancer, cardiac, and sadly, by their own hands. For too long in the fire service, we've been asked to fix our problems with bake sales, meat raffles, chewing gum, and baling wire. And it's time that policymakers and other folks have to step up and look out for the men and women that are providing the important safety net in our state. This bill, from the moment it's passed, will provide relief for 22,000 men and women that are serving the citizens of Minnesota. And it's for a relatively small investment, and I urge the committee to pass this bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Parsons. And you and I have had opportunity to talk about this approach for a couple of years now, and I know that it's rooted in reality and responding to the loss of your colleagues and friends. You have my continued support and empathy on that. But there's more that we can do than to offer that, particularly in terms of preventing future losses. And so thank you for the great care and love, quite frankly, that you and your colleagues have put into constructing this proposal. With that, we'll move on to Steve Shapira, retired St. Paul Fire St. Paul Fire Captain, Captain Shapira.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. My name is Steve Shapira. I am a retired fire captain from St. Paul, and I have 23 years in the fire service, and I am also the Minnesota State Director for the Firefighter Cancer Support Network. So I field the calls generally along with MinFire when we get a diagnosis in the state. My story starts as a cancer survivor back in 2014 when I had some abdominal pain in the spring. And I started a round of treatments and inquiries to find out what was wrong with me. And it took about 6 or 8 months, and I had every treatment you could think of, numerous blood draws, x-rays, CTs. I had an upper GI endoscopy, ultrasounds, every treatment known. And I started to realize after being an EMT all these years, they couldn't really find out what was going on with me. At that time, my three girls were a lot younger at that point, and it was the fall of the year. And I said, I'm just going to take a time out with everything and just give them a normal Thanksgiving and Christmas. And I picked up in the spring of 2014 at the University of Minnesota after a referral from a friend. I sat down in March at the University of Minnesota. They came in and they took my vital signs. And the internist came in, shook my hand, and he pulled up my CT that was taken 6 months before. And in 5 seconds and three clicks of the mouse, he looked at me and said, "You have non-Hodgkin's lymphoma." And he circled it right on the screen like John Madden would on a Monday Night Football play. And I knew at that point everything in my life was going to change. I knew my career was in jeopardy, my finances, my relationship with my wife, my kids. And when I speak about this, it ended up forcing me into retirement. So non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, if you're not familiar, is a cancer that firefighters get at a 51% greater rate than the general public. The average onset age for that cancer is 65. I got it at 45, and it's a blood-based cancer similar to a leukemia, so the only treatment for that really is chemotherapy. So I started with 8 aggressive rounds of chemotherapy very shortly thereafter, and continued with another 12 rounds, so 20 total rounds of chemotherapy after 2.5 years, which, as I said, forced me into retirement. We had no support system at that point, and in fact, when I got my diagnosis of occupational firefighter cancer, that was the first time I had heard of occupational firefighter cancer, because at that point, the state of Minnesota had not had any training in occupational firefighter cancer. And I had no resources. Their MinFire wasn't created at that point. And we certainly didn't have any sort of a network of trained medical people to understand the differences that firefighters go through and the different screenings and tests that firefighters need, and that we do need to be screened at younger ages for all these different ailments. So I stand here today as a survivor and for a voice of those who are no longer here. It's, as Mr. Parsons said, it's too many to count. Literally, it is too many to count that we've lost to all these combined. In particular, as I said, I field the calls for cancer, and I just received a call again last week of another really tragic diagnosis. So I stand here for all of the people who do not have voices for this anymore. And in particular, I stand here for my friend, our friend who served the community for 25 years, Mike Pider, who lost his battle in August of last year. Thank you. And I'll stand for any questions also.
Thank you, Captain Shapira. And my condolences on the loss of your friend and our public servant as well. And thank you for your public service to the people, good people of St. Paul, my city, and people of Minnesota. And it seems to me more than reasonable, but a right request that we together step up and stand with our firefighters and provide them with the safety net that you and others are calling for. Thank you, sir. With that, we have Jen France, who is the widow of cardiac victim Matt France, fire chief was a fire chief in Rice Lake, Minnesota. Ms. France, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and provide us with your testimony.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Jen France. I am here today to speak to you a little bit about my late husband, and I appreciate you taking the time to listen. On December 9th, 2013, the day started out with Matt getting an early morning call for mutual aid for a chimney fire. For us, this wasn't unusual. He was often up in the middle of the night, you know, running out the door. When he returned home, he was able to get a little bit of rest before he had to get up and go do his regular civilian job as a UPS driver. Communication throughout the day was off and on, texting, you know, when he had a chance. Eventually, those texts stopped coming and he stopped responding. And I didn't really think anything of it. I just thought he was busy. But 3 hours later, I was met in the driveway at home with the sheriff's deputy who had come to give me the news that my husband would not be returning home. He had suffered what they believed was a massive heart attack. And I apologize, it's been a while, but it still hits hard.
Of course.
And Matt, he was such a dedicated chief. He was truly aware of his fire family's health. He wanted to make sure everybody took care of themselves and that they had the resources to do that and to receive help if they needed it. Unfortunately, circumstances are out of our control. And actually, 14 months after his death, his department lost another member due to a cardiac event. So this has become very important to me. And I know that if he was here, he would be right out in front supporting this. He always wanted to take care of everyone and even himself. He was a healthy 42-year-old man. So when he died of a cardiac event, that was just, it was shocking for all of us. But as I said, I know he would be right out front supporting a bill like the Hometown Heroes Assistance Program. And since he is not here, I feel it is my duty to still support what he did for our community, especially as a volunteer, and to back support for this bill. And I hope that members will take this into consideration and move forward and approve this so that we can help our firefighters and give them the assistance that they need to stay healthy and to be in a good place so they can help us. Thank you very much for your time. I appreciate it.
Oh, we appreciate you. Thank you so much, Ms. France. And I am certain I speak on behalf of our entire committee here of extending our love and our deep condolences to you and healing thoughts and prayers for you and your family. Thank you for the gift of the public service that your husband provided to the good people of Minnesota.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Members, we have two members, Representative Hewitt and Cleavorn, then we're going to move the way over because we need to get to Representative Marquardt's bill, our final bill here before us. And so,
Chair Mariani, I do have an amendment for this bill.
Representative Johnson, you're correct. There is an A2 amendment. Representative Johnson, why don't we just go to your amendment?
Chair Mariani, members, this is the same, basically the same amendment as I had yesterday, but this is a little different. Yesterday, the grant money was going to a department of the state, the Department of Office, or OJP. This time, we're giving, if I remember correctly, we don't even have the amount of dollars into a nonprofit. It's not a department. State Department of the State is a nonprofit organization that's a 501c3.
I support this bill very much, but it really gets me concerned because I actually been sitting here for the last 20 minutes trying to find even the list of the board of directors of this nonprofit, and I cannot find them. When we're giving this money away that's designed to go to the heroes in our communities, our firefighters, along with a lot of fires, law enforcement officers in our communities are also firefighters. I want to make sure that the money actually gets to them. So that's where this amendment is very important. This amendment requires no more than 1% of the total amount appropriated in administrative costs. I want to have this money get to our heroes. It's important that they do. They've gone through a lot. They give us a lot. 90% of fighters are volunteers. And without our volunteers, we wouldn't have fire departments. Our cities couldn't, a lot of our cities can't, small cities especially can't afford to have full-time fire departments. They don't have the tax base to do that, unlike Minneapolis and St. Paul and a lot of these urban cities. The rural cities is different. We need our volunteers. And so I'm going to ask for your support for this amendment to make sure that the funds do get to the firefighters and the hometown heroes.
Very well. Thank you, Representative Johnson. And just to make sure, Representative Johnson moves adoption of the A2 amendment. Representative Joaquin.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to ask members for no vote on this amendment. Representative Johnson, those same heroes that you're talking about are the ones that run this program. And small town firefight departments that don't have the resources would benefit from having this program so that their firefighters could have the chance to have support. I wish you would have come to talk to me about this amendment. This is the third year we've had the Hometown Heroes Act introduced and the second time it's been in front of this committee, and you have not approached me with your concerns. Since this bill is being laid over, though, I would like to take time to work with the advocates and see what they think the cost would be in administering this program. It's an important program. It's a large program. And I want to make sure that we don't put an arbitrary low number on administrative costs. So, members, please vote no.
Very well.
Chair Mariani.
Representative Johnson.
There again. The concern I have is right now the bill has no parameters around administrative costs. We could give them $3 million, and they could take a third of that because there is no parameters just for administrative costs. I don't think they would. I believe it's a good organization, but we do need to do our due diligence to make sure that we have parameters set. Thank you.
Representative Johnson, I'm just curious, and I guess this is a question for both you and Chair Joaquin. I do think it makes sense that there be a clear expectation of what administrative costs are without prejudice here. I'm wondering if it would be possible for – we'll take a vote on the amendment for sure if you want. I'm wondering if we need to do that. I think we heard from Representative Joaquin that she would work with the advocates to be able to identify that, and I presume that would mean working with you. At least I would hope so. So that's one approach, but we can certainly vote on amendments. I'm just offering you that opportunity, Representative Johnson.
If she's willing to work and make sure we get the right parameters set in, I would be more than happy to withdraw the amendment.
Very well. Thank you, Representative Johnson. Representative Joaquin, just for the record, working with Representative Johnson in terms of coming back with some answer relative to this issue of administrative costs so that we're real clear about where the people's money would, how it will be spent.
Yes, Chair. Chair Mariani, you have my word on that.
Very well. All right. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you both. I appreciate that very much. With that, members, we're going to lay this bill over. So we will be working this bill. And boy, I'm hoping we can get this across the finish line this year, Representative Joaquin. Thank you so much for bringing this bill forward. And thank you for all the wonderful public servants and family of public servants who have been with us here
Thank you, Chair Mariani. I just wanted to say thank you so much for hearing it again. This is an epidemic in our firefighting community, one that our cities, towns, and townships can't handle on their own. And as a state, I believe that we're morally obligated to step up and help, and I thank you.
We thank you as well, Representative Yorkey. With that, the chair lays over House File 377 for possible inclusion in this committee's omnibus finance bill. Members, next up is House File 499. My good friend Paul Marquardt, Representative Marquardt, and I have served in this body together for, I'm not telling Paul, but for quite a while. And so the chair will move to refer House File 499 to the Committee on Ways and Means, and we're going to be laying this over as well for possible inclusion. But for now, let's hear the bill from the from Chair Marquardt and testifiers. Chair Marquardt, your bill.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members. And Mr. Chair, we do go back a ways, and it's been an honor to serve with you those years. And especially, you remember 2013 and 2014, we were both chairs in the education committees and worked very closely on that and appreciated that. So, members, House File 499 is not a new bill for this committee. And what it would do is appropriate $3 million in fiscal year 22 and $3 million in fiscal year 23 that would go to the Homeland Security and Emergency Management Division that then would award grants out in equal proportions to our 87 counties, our 11 federally recognized tribes, and our four cities of the first class. So you kind of divide that out, it would be about $29,400 to each of those entities as they would apply for these grants. And they could use these grants for preparedness, readiness, for capital expenses. And also as part of this bill, there would be a report that would have to be issued by the Department of Public Safety talking about these grants. So the big question is why? You know, what's the big importance? And I know there are several members on this committee that are, you know, first responders in emergency management, and so very familiar with that. But Minnesota Statute 12.25 requires that every state have an emergency management director and a deputy director. And of course, the responsibility is very important. They are responsible in their counties for protecting the safety of people during disasters. And this can be a natural disaster as a tornado or a flood, or it can be an accidental or man-made disaster, including a pandemic like we've seen this year with COVID-19. And so it's a lot of responsibility with very limited funding for these counties. I mean, they need to mitigate when it comes to disasters. Their major priority is preparing and readiness, but they also have to look at response and recovery. And one interesting thing, if you look at that map that was included that has the number of disasters, one thing you know is that disasters do not care about what the population of a county is or what the resources of that county is to be able to address that disaster. And if you look at that, Renville County had eight state-declared disasters since 2014. Kitson County, six, and Norman County has had four. If you total up those three counties, it's 25,000 population, 18 state-declared disasters in a population of 25,000. So you can see the tremendous burden that these can put on, especially smaller counties. And so this bill, you know, since there is no state funding right now, the funding that county emergency managers get come through grants, through Homeland Security, and then those are matched through local county property tax dollars. So this would provide some state funding. It would help really provide these county managers with funds that they're being really strapped with, especially now with COVID-19 and all the response that they have to do there. But it would be money to assure that these county emergency managers can provide for their number one goal, and that is the safety of residents and preparing for disasters that might occur. So, Mr. Chair, I have here a constituent of mine, but also the Norman County Emergency Manager and past president of the Association of Minnesota Emergency Managers, in Gary Johansson. I'd like to turn it over to him if I could, Mr. Chair.
Yes, indeed. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Director Johansson. Please state your name for the record and give us your testimony.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you hear me? First of all,
and I love your backdrop there as well.
Yeah, it was 26 below when I came in. I wasn't sure if the internet was still frozen up or not. But again, thank you, Chair Mariani, and members of the committee. And thank you, Representative Marquardt, for authoring this very important bill. My name is Gary Johansson. I am Norman County's emergency manager, have been for about 8 years. I'm also AMEM's past president. AMEM is Emergency Management or Association of Emergency Management, and also AMEM's legislative committee member. I just want to talk briefly this morning about emergency management and the funding issues that we're currently having. Emergency management covers a broad spectrum of planning duties, but as you narrow the scope, we can define emergency management in four core phases, and Paul touched on this. They are mitigation, preparedness, response, and recovery. I mean, there are core duties of what we do here, and core duties of what I've been doing for 8 years. But emergency managers cannot perform these core duties without an adequate funding system. Currently, there is a lack of stable and sustainable funding for local emergency management programs, which also include planning, training, and operations. Yesterday, we took a survey, and we threw it out to the entire state of Minnesota emergency managers. And we asked them, is the emergency management program in your county, the city of the first class, or tribal nations funded to the level necessary to adequately carry out federal and state required services? Unbelievably, we had 73 respondents within about 12 hours, and 92% said no. So that's troubling to me, you know, as a former AMEM president and as many years as I've been working as an emergency manager, to get that many no's out of 73 emergency managers across the state, at 92% no. Local government across the state, we're heavily dependent on federal grants. Norman County's emergency management program grant, we call it EMPG, is $16,000 a year. And that's to run my whole program for a year. The state legislature does not appropriate any state general funds to help pay for our daily operations. And it's apparent that as of late, natural disasters are not only increasing, but increasing in intensity in Minnesota. Paul touched on this too. And last year in 2020, Norman County had two state disaster declarations, flooding in the spring, which we normally get, and severe weather and flooding in the late summer. Now, disaster duties for an emergency manager like me begin with initial damage assessments. And it takes about a six-month process from start to finish on average. Now, I'll throw in the COVID-19 pandemic duties, and up here in northern Minnesota, the Lion 3 installation. My position in a hurry becomes full-time. If this AMEM funding initiative is approved, emergency managers across Minnesota will use the funding in a variety of ways. On our survey, we also threw this out and asked them what they would use it for. We had a lot of responses like this. Part-time emergency managers may transition to full-time positions. Full-time emergency managers may add part-time staff to help with extra duties. I see my county, Norman County, using the funding to buy needed EM equipment and to catch up with essential trainings and exercises required by the state yearly in my county. My duties and responsibilities follow the same guidelines and training standards that are required in large metropolitan cities. In closing, Mr. Chair, we all know that emergency management is a critical government function. Emergency managers cannot prevent an emergency or natural disaster from occurring. But we do spend much of our time preparing for these events. We perform exercises and drills to prepare our vulnerable communities for emergencies. These preparations take money and time. We cannot properly prepare our community without adequate funding. Thus, we leave our communities vulnerable. That burden falls on all of us if that worst day occurs in our community and they're not prepared. So with that, I thank you, Chair Marani, committee members, and Jamal for taking the time to listen to Representative Mark Court and I discuss this important funding initiative with you today.
Thank you, Mr. Johansson. We did have this conversation last year as well. Thank you for the reminder, frankly, that emergency management is a core government function for us. I do note that the bill applies for all 87 counties.
Yes.
But I also do want to recognize that there is a geographic equity issue here relative to the finance capacity of sparsely populated counties like Renville, for instance. We heard from the sheriff of Renville a couple of weeks ago, and he shared the challenges of his public safety work in a county, of his geographic size with, a relatively sparse population relative to the rest of the state. You know, it's not all one size fits all in our state, but I do think what we hold in common is that we are very effective if we're able to have the ability to work across jurisdictions.
Yes.
With one another, and this kind of investment on the part of the state would help us to be more effective, even as you're currently being very efficient with the resources that you have. We do have questions and comments. We have Representative Johnson, Representative Raleigh. Representative Johnson.
Chair Mariani, Representative Markarth, I want to thank you for bringing this forward. I myself at one time was a emergency management director for my small city I lived in. And my budget for the entire year was less than, I think it was $500. I like the concept that you're doing here, but I do have some concerns. Although you have the cities of the first class, which usually have a very large tax base that they can spread the cost out. And granted, they have a lot more work to do, but a lot of work in these small towns and across the state, cities like in your area, Ada, and in my area, it's Cambridge and Braham. We got International Falls, which have other issues because of being a border city. These emergency management directors for these small towns don't have the capacity, and these small cities don't have the capacity to fund their emergency management directors the way they should as well. I would hope you'd consider adding these small cities, especially in greater Minnesota, because like it's been said, we do not have the resources here to do what needs to be done, yet these cities are still mandated to do these things as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. Representative Raleigh.
Thank you, Chair. My question is, I want to make sure that I understand the language correctly. Testifier said that these will be distributed in equal proportions. The bill says equal amounts, and then I have a follow-up to that question, if I could, please. And which one is it? Is it proportions or amounts?
Very well, Representative Markler.
So thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Raleigh. My understanding is it's equal amounts. So you take $3 million divided by 102 jurisdictions, that comes to roughly $29,400. That is my understanding, and I don't quite know the differential between that, but I could be corrected on that.
Let's see if anyone's going to correct you, I don't think so. It may be worth a little bit further diving to Representative Raleigh's inquiry. Representative Raleigh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The second question that I had was the language is pretty clear that each of these organizations need to make an application to be able to get these grants. What happens to the money if not all of the municipalities make a request, and how do they roll over into year two and then in the tails, Mr. Chair?
Very well, Chair Markworth.
So if Mr. Johansson can answer this, I think we were asked that question last year. So Mr. Johansson, I think, has the answer to this.
Yeah, we were.
Director Johansson.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. And it's true that there are going to be some communities or counties cities of the first class or 11 tribal nations that won't accept the money. The money will roll over into the next year for the next round of grant writings. It's true that we write these grants through the Homeland Security at the state of Minnesota in equal amounts of $29,000. So we did have that question come up last year. And again, yes, there will be some that don't take it. It'll roll over the next year. And this is a biennium, $3 million per year for 2 years. Hope that helps.
Very well. Thank you, Director. Representative Raleigh, you're good?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. No further questions.
Very well. Great questions. Representative Johnson, I see your hand up again. Is that from prior or is that for now? No,
I don't. I apologize for having it up.
That's all right. I'd rather be safe than sorry. So, very well. I don't see any other questions here. Representative Marquardt, some parting thoughts, encouragements, words of wisdom?
No, thank you very much, Mr. Chair, for hearing this and the committee for your attention and that. And I know everyone understands the need, and I think Mr. Johansson indicated just everything that's done, and budgets are being stretched here for a very, very important job of protecting people in the most difficult time. So, again, I appreciate your consideration and for hearing the bill, Mr. Chair.
Very well. Members, the chair will lay over House File 499 for possible inclusion in our omnibus finance bill. Look forward to the conversation as we going forward as we prepare that omnibus bill.
Thank you, members, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Johansson, and hopefully you'll be able to – you've got a very nice-looking sweater. I take it. It's doing the job up there at 25 below.
There's like four layers on here, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members, for giving us the time today.
Absolutely. Thank you, sir. Thank you for your work. Members, next week we're going to hear a number of bills for Survivor Advocacy Week. There's going to be some big, beefy bills. Ranging from investigations related to recommendations from the Sexual Assault Task Force that we created a couple of years ago, bringing forward some good recommendations, I believe. We're going to hear the Missing and Murdered African-American Women's Bill, a couple of bills, number of bills on human trafficking, and a few others as well. Bring a good cup of coffee. We're going to have hopefully some very good, strong conversations. But there will be quite a number of bills before us. So until then, stay warm. It's going to be a real cold weekend, everyone. And I look forward to seeing you all again next week. Until then, this committee stands adjourned.